Welcome to the Phoenix Cast, a podcast about cybersecurity, technology, and innovation issues in the military. We are your hosts, John.
And Kyle.
I'm a U.S. Marine, and the opinions expressed on the cast are my own, not official military policy.
And the opinions expressed by me are also my own, not those of my employer or any other businesses I happen to be associated with.
For today's episode, no special guest, just the love between the hosts.
That's right. And in preparation for today's episode, we're going to do things a little less formally because John and I have decided to take a very interesting tract here. A new article came out, published on thehill.com, which I'm sure is the most cutting edge of all things, but it's getting a little bit of traction on social media, and we wanted to come in and talk a little bit about it. John, do you want to give us a little intro into this article?
Yeah, absolutely. And so first thing I want to say is this is an amazing article to spur conversation. I would not say this is an article that I, John, took point by point and thought to myself, I'm modeling stuff off of this. But you will hear this throughout the cast. The rough general idea of the article is saying, hey, for the U.S. to maintain their strategic advantage, they need to address vulnerabilities in our weapon systems.
So we're not talking about Windows XP here. We're talking about weapon systems, John.
No, and in the kind of normal IT parlance, you generally hear the IT networks and the OT networks. Now, I don't know if you would separate this as like kind of like information technology, operational technology, and like warfighting technology, or you would kind of bin these in the OT bin. I think probably since, you know, if you were working a manufacturing line, your sensors and lasers and welders would all be part of that OT network. So I would imagine you'll probably bin missiles and tanks and infantry fighting vehicles and such under kind of military version of OT network.
Yeah, I think if someone pressured me into making a decision on this, I would say that if your profession and your business is being a warfighter, then all of these things are definitely in the OT space.
Yeah, so one of the first examples that the article starts off with, it says, hey, let's make sure we take on the lessons learned from Ukraine, Russia. And it says specifically, you know, think about asymmetric warfare, and Russia hit Ukraine's power grid, transportation networks, and satellite communications.
And not for the first time, right? There's a stark and real history of Russia doing this over and over to the Ukraine. If you want to look at sort of a playbook for cyber defense learning, the Ukraine's playbook is not a bad one in which to follow. And they have severely, or maybe that's the wrong word here, but they have significantly increased their cyber defense at the nation level because they have seen, you know, the wolf at the door, if you will, for a decade almost. So you couldn't have a nation that was more ready and prepared, I think, and yet still was subject to massive cyber attacks.
Yes. And many of the books that we have recommended throughout the episodes of the podcast here have addressed the after actions of what Kyle's talking about. So I don't think we need to go into that further. But one of the specific things the article calls out, it says policymakers should consider other non-conventional attacks, such as against the U.S. weapon systems. Now, this is where I like first line in the article, I already have some problems. So first, it's saying we should think about asymmetric attacks and warfare. And it says power grid, transportation, satellite. And I'm like, okay, that makes sense. Those, maybe you could consider those kind of like OT type networks. And then it says we need to look at non-conventional attacks like against weapon systems. And I got to ask myself, what would you think conventionally cyber would attack?
Right.
Would you think weapon systems would be non-conventional attacks? I feel like that would be symmetric warfare. Like the cyber force on force, I would imagine, would be taking out the weapon systems that they use. So I'm scratching my head a little bit on how we're like, we should think outside the box. We should hit the military. And it's kind of like,
yeah, I don't think that weapon systems would be considered asymmetric or non-conventional in any way, shape, or form. I think if we, you know, flip the map around and say we are, you know, trying to take out an adversary in some way, shape, or form, I think those are smack dab in the middle of everyone wants to take them out list. And it's not some novel, unique, crazy thing that there is no playbook for. I think that if you have the ability to take out someone's anything, their tanks, their airframes, their weapon systems, their targeting systems, their communication systems, that feels like almost the most conventional method of doing so in a cyber warfare capability.
Okay. I am glad to hear that you at least somewhat read this the same way I do, but so that we're maybe not incorrectly parsing the words, let's kind of take it back to Big Blue Arrows. Do you think, Kyle, our U.S. strategic advantage is predicated on us taking care of vulnerabilities in our weapon systems? Or at least is that in your top three of things you think we should do to maintain strategic advantage?
All right. So top three I take umbrage with, for the record, okay. Right? Like you have to, you know, if you're going to tell me you have to choose three, this
right
sucks.
Now.
Right,
yeah.
Right. I don't know that I would say that the cyber defense of our weapon systems is top three towards the defense of our nation or the maintenance of our warfighting capability. I do think that it has to be addressed somewhere along that line. I think that when you talk about combat readiness, right, cleaning your weapon system and making sure that a weapon system that heavily relies on a cyber element making sure that a weapon system that relies on a cyber element has defenses lined up for it, or is, I don't know, I'm just going to think conventionally here, like patched to the latest version for all the software stacks that it is on and, you know, has some form of regular check or penetration system that is checking to see if we can get in. That feels right. And that feels maybe not apples to apples, but at least apples to small round fruit.
Interesting.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do know what you mean. So let me take this a step further, because I think you put me onto something that might be there. So do you think maintaining these weapons vulnerabilities, are you saying that's less of climbing the highest mountain than it is making sure that you don't have rust or carbon buildup on your M16?
I feel strongly that that is an exact analog. I would say that if you were going to let a tank sit in depot and never get maintenance on it for a decade, and you're going to let some high-end targeting system never get a patch, never be vulnerability scanned for a decade, those are the same level of negligence. Now, I'm probably using negligence strongly there for this particular circumstance, but I think if you're going to yell at the PFC or the Lance Corporal for having rust on their end of their rifle, you should equally yell at some program manager who has, you know, solar winds that's still vulnerable from 2 years ago. Terrible example, but you get the idea.
I don't think your negligence is wrong there, because I think any commander who tried to pull the bolt on M16 or M4 of one of his Marines and it's rusted, and he asked, when did you clean this? And they said, never.
Right.
I think they would use the word negligent in the charge sheet. So you're probably onto something there.
Yeah. And I mean, we're a little bit afield on this topic thread, but I think this is the correct way to think about it. Is this article, again, not winning the Pulitzer, but good for conversation starting. Like anyone who's reading this, who is an officer or commander, this is great fodder for you to talk to your Marines about, to talk about cyber when turning the map around and thinking through things just like this. I do think that the article points out, and we'll get to this here in a second, that more is needed. And I absolutely 100% agree. I think the entire purpose of this cast is that we feel strongly in that direction. I do think some of the recommendations that they make are immature. And I do think that some of the ways that they describe things are maybe poorly researched, but that shouldn't stop us from sort of chatting through them.
Perfect. Well, let's speak of things that are confusing and or poorly researched. So the rough line of progression here goes, the U.S. has weapon systems. Those weapon systems have digital vulnerabilities. As NATO and Russia come, I put an R at the end of that. That's terrible. As NATO Russia. And Russia move towards a potential issue that could lead to an escalation, there is a higher chance of those vulnerabilities being exposed. That was an area where the article really lost me. Do you think, and if it lost me, maybe it lost the rest of the readers. So can you explain this in a way that makes sense to me? Because I don't know how you got there from U.S. weapon systems. Since they are connected, they have digital vulnerabilities. With you, got it. And then NATO and Russia being in the same space and all the things in the news, chances for escalation, I'm with you there too. Those chances of escalation leading to a higher chance our vulnerabilities are exposed, I'm completely confused as to how we got there.
I think that, again, there's some language that's lost in here. The way that I interpreted this particular section, John, I agree with you 100%. We have weapon systems. Those weapon systems rely on technology. Technology is inherently vulnerable to, you know, digital attack in some way, shape, or form. And then, so that feels like the associative property of you're using technology. Now we get into there's a conflict, active conflict, whether that's cold, hot, or otherwise in some way, shape, or form. The way that I interpret that is to say nations that are actively engaged in conflict may be far more willing to use their stash of digital weapons than they would have been in the past. And generally speaking, the use of digital weapons in any battlefield is the exposure of said weapon, right? You can't, if I develop a really high technology missile and I'm the United States and I use that missile, it's very, very hard for someone to be like, ah, I see missile, I can copy missile, now I has missile. That's not how it works in the conventional warfare. But when it comes to cyber attacks and cyber defense, if you use a vulnerability, everyone can generally see what that vulnerability is. The way that the software and the technology deploys often gives copies, and when I say copies, I mean exact copies, to your adversaries that you're using them against, assuming they can mitigate that attack, and then you're effectively handing them the same weapon system. So there is the potential that there are more zero days that large nation states know about that would be exposed or released or made aware to the industry writ large, and that then could have a higher chance of the number of them being exposed. I think that there's a subtle nuance here that says those vulnerabilities would actively already be known because they'd be sitting in someone's zero-day stash, right? Like it's not that we're going to find more because of conflict. It's that the ones that are already known have a higher odd of being released and therefore disclosed publicly.
Okay. Number one, Thunder Stealer, because that is exactly where I was going next. It was like, hey, wait a minute. If they used them, that means they had it. And I think from a strategic advantage standpoint, and interest in your parsing my thought process here, from strategic advantage, if a nation state has the ability to nullify or repurpose or whatever my weapons through 0 days, whether they use it or they do not, my strategic advantage is at the same place, or possibly them using it in a less than opportune time, i.e. maybe force on force Russia, Ukraine, compared to, you know, some people are saying maybe it escalates to US, Russia. If they would use it now, that might be to our strategic advantage, because now we know, now we can patch, and then that won't be a problem as things escalate. I would argue using it might even in some weird way increase our strategic advantage. Your thoughts?
This is a very interesting sort of Rube Goldberg machine that gets really, really hard to predict the farther out you want to try and look. There is a concept in the like Richard Kahneman Thinking Fast and Slow methodology of like a wicked problem, which is where like a traveling salesman problem that really has no true way that you can ever know what the end is going to be, or there's no way that you can ever prove that you have the most efficient methodology of thinking through this. If you use, let's just assume that this conflict in Russia is the onus of this entire article, which they insinuate, if not outright saying multiple times, if Russia would use a cyber offensive that would take out some form of weapon system that the Ukraine is currently using, if that's even remotely located in the same battle space or the same technology space as any of our weapon systems, yes, I think that is an advantage for us, right? We selfishly, the United States, probably want Russia to tip their hand of attacks they know about or vulnerabilities that they have in their toolkit when it's not against us or our allies. Although, you know, this is obviously against our allies, but I just mean in a controlled environment or controlled battle space like what we have currently. Now, Russia's decision making about whether to use those vulnerabilities, because again, once the genie's out of the bottle, you cannot put it back in. It's not like you can be like, boop, I compromised the system. You don't know what I did. Muhaha, I'm going to go do it again in 6 months or in a year or whatever. It's pretty much out there. So there is a point of no return when you choose to engage in cyber weapons using new 0 days, that you let the cat out of the bag. You get one good shot at that where no one knows what's happening. And this is where, again, you know, talking about books, when we look at like Stuxnet and, you know, previous things in the past where there's like layering of these 0 days that no one knew about, which made it this incredibly powerful payload. There will be things like that. And the more you give that away, the more you give away signatures, the more you give away the vulnerabilities themselves, the less effective you are in the future. I think we talked about this on a previous cast too, John. I was somewhat shocked that there wasn't a larger cyber offensive against the Ukraine at the beginning of this conflict. I mean, I know that there were things, but I was somewhat shocked that there wasn't significantly more that came out of it. And I think that there might have been a lot of calculus behind the scenes with the decision makers on the other side of the map, if you will, to say, maybe that's not to our advantage to use that now.
Or to bring you back to one of our earlier podcasts, maybe there were, And maybe reporting wise, it was not in the Ukraine's best interest to tell you
that's
what
right.
happened.
100%. And so many
equally
layers,
likely, right?
Exactly. Exactly. I think that it's hard to keep a lot of the real large scale cyber vulnerabilities under wraps. I think there's the industry itself is too interconnected. The risks involved in certain pieces of malware getting out, right? Or being I don't know the right way to describe this, but like it's tough sometimes to keep things targeted on exactly what they want. There's so many interconnected
unconstrained.
Systems. Yeah, unconstrained. That's good. There's it's so hard to keep things exactly on target in the cyber realm that I like to think that there is that we would know more if there was a larger campaign. But you're right, John. There could be a whole lot unknown.
There's a whole lot that goes into cyber, as it turns out. So next point, or I guess sub point under that kind of exposure of vulnerabilities. The article also says Congress has the power to improve cybersecurity and weapon systems, but is not taking advantage, and every year that goes by is essentially making it worse. I don't
and
know
grass
if
is
I
green.
Yeah, and grass is green and sky is blue. But I mean, I don't know if I necessarily disagree with this point. Every year that you choose not to improve cybersecurity, yes, it probably diminishes your strategic advantage. Especially if you think weapon systems are the main driver of our, or at least a major driver of our strategic advantage by not keeping their software, assuming that the software is not up to date, by not doing that, that would, every year that goes by, diminish that. There's a lot of, I use the word assumption a lot of times there. So, you know, this could also be feelings ball as well. So that should also be heavily considered.
Yeah, the assumptive nature of this, I think, is correct. I think that, of course, we can throw more money, more people, more resources at these cyber problems, and we can have an increased response and an increased capability set. And sure, every year that we don't increase them, it does get worse. And this is the age-old problem of government spending, right? There's only so many dollars, and you got to put them in so many places. And, you know, what's more important, cybersecurity or NASA, right? Like, well, that depends greatly on exactly the type of question you want to ask, the type of application of technology you want to use. And it's an impossible question to answer. They are
and perfect 2020 right? hindsight. You'll know the answer to that question 20 years from now as you look back on it.
Right. And humans in general, we're terrible predictors of the future, just absolutely terrible predictors of the future. So this is hard. I think the article's right. Congress has that power. Our legislative branches of the government have that power to set dollars and investments and things like that. But I don't necessarily know that I would look at that situation and say a huge amount of blame is currently on Congress or any of the legislative bodies. I think that there are far more problems with the average cyber knowledge of a sitting senator or congressperson. And I don't mean that from an ignorance perspective. I mean that from just, it's hard to learn this stuff, right?
Yeah.
It's hard, you know, it's easier if you're younger, it's harder if you're older. There's a lot of things that go into where just cyber is hard, right? Go watch any of those congressional interviews of Mark Zuckerberg and Sundar and, you know, all these executives from tech. Those are painful to watch in a lot of ways if you're in this industry, because it makes you realize the lowest common denominator of cyber intelligence is much lower than we expect. And we get tunnel vision for that, right? Like, John, you and I are huge CrossFitters, right? The CrossFit Games is happening as we record this. And
yes, it is.
You know, we look at all these people and go, oh, these are the fittest people on the planet. And we go to our gyms and we go, these are the fittest people I've seen today. And then we go into like general population. We go, oh, wait, why isn't everyone fitter? And I think that happens to us in the cyber realm as well. We're so we're so involved in this all day. We're talking about this every single day. And it's like, yeah, but that's because we're in it. We're deeply in it, right? Everyone else that has so many other things going on in their professional lives and their professional career don't consider these things the way that we do. And that's just hard, right? And I don't think that that is going to change anytime soon. And therefore, I'm just thankful that we are talking about these things at the national level.
I agree with you. Let's move on to some examples to illustrate just what you are talking about. Can you take us through, there were some declassified examples as part of the report. Can you take us through those? And then let's parse that a little bit just to do your thing we're talking about of like, let's take it from the lowest common denominator and move it up a bit.
Right. So again, we're going to have a link to this article from The Hill in the show notes, and there are a bunch of links inside of that article that we're going to be talking about right now. So one of these links is an Inspector General report from February of 2021 that has since been declassified, that talks about a number of discoveries of cyber vulnerabilities in large weapon systems. I'm just going to give a quick example of this and why it is interesting if you read this redacted version and this unclassified version of it, because it's kind of funny, only because the very first example it talks about is an advanced anti-radiation guided missile. And it talks about there was discovered a problem with the way that the radio transmissions happened. They don't talk about what was discovered or what was remediated, but there was a problem with radio transmissions. And then the very next example is the B-2 bomber, like the thing that is in all of the Hollywood movies that drops nuclear weapons. And it's, I'm gonna literally read you everything that is not redacted from the report about the cyber vulnerability discovered in the B-2 bomber. It says, the B-2 program officials assessed cybersecurity risks and took actions to mitigate those cybersecurity threats on the program. The B-2 Spirit is a long-range bomber that is capable of delivering both nuclear and conventional weapons. Then figure 5 shows a B-2 Spirit in flight. And then the program entered the ONS phase of the acquisition cycle, and they updated their cybersecurity requirements based on the intelligence threat assessments and cyber resiliency penetration tests. So it literally said, we found something on the B-2. The B-2 is a bomber. Here's a picture of the thing. And by the way, we remediated it. That's everything else is just black lines in this document.
I love those reactions. It's so great.
It's really funny. Like, you know, like, here is a picture of the thing. The thing had vulnerabilities. We fixed the thing. No other details were given in any way, shape, or form for very obvious reasons. And it goes through and it talks a little bit more about the AC-130J. It talks about the infantry fighting vehicle and a few other weapon systems that are in here that are the names of these weapon systems are redacted. But, you know, advanced weapon systems, take that for whatever you will. And it's a report that just says we found problems. This is a bit like a penetration test that you would get if you were a commercial provider or a commercial vendor, right? Like you hire a third party to come in. That's what this report is from, with the Inspector General. And they come in and they bring experts who look at your system and they say, ah, you know what? You're using a bad version of TLS, or, you know, there's just 1,000 things that you can do with penetration tests on systems these days. And this report basically says we found stuff. Stuff was remediated and now things are good. I think the struggle with this is the way the article describes it is that massive vulnerabilities were detected. And it seems to imply that they were not remediated in some way, shape, or form, which I take a little bit of umbrage with that, too, because this report is very clear that there is a consistent and ongoing effort with all the weapon systems that are described in here to continuously identify and find vulnerabilities and mitigate them so that we're, you know, going into battle or going into readiness with the most readied version of these things that we can. Like, am I worried that the B-2 bomber has additional cyber vulnerabilities? Sure. Am I worried that no one cares? Absolutely not. And I think that's a interesting bit and piece. So that's my TLDR on this document, which, by the way, it's not that long. It's only like 20 pages. And it's actually a really good read if you want to, for what's not redacted anyway. But just if you look at the methodologies that they talk about in the beginning and the remediation steps that they talk about at the end, this is an interesting way for you to think about how high level programs within the DoD are objectively checked for vulnerabilities.
Excellent. So a couple of things I wanted to point out. Do you remember a couple of years ago at Black Hat, they made a big deal about the fact that they could start and stop a Jeep?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yes.
So one of the big reasons that was such a big deal is because the Jeep was connected to the internet.
Right.
Right. And the Jeep did not have, an external firewall with dynamically updated policies, et cetera, et cetera, right? It was connected to the internet. It was reachable and there was a vulnerability.
Right.
So hashtag not all created equal. So I will make the assumption that they did not just connect the infantry carrier vehicle to the internet ad hoc, right? So yeah, right. they could have a really bad vulnerability in maybe a switch that connects everything inside. This is all fantasy land hypothetical. None of this is researched or backed up, right? But theoretically, you could have a bad vulnerability in a switch in the infantry carrier vehicle. And then I could write a report that says there is a terrible vulnerability that if the enemy exploited could take charge of everything. And theoretically there could be a world in which it happened. But if it's only internally wired and there's no other vulnerabilities that we know about that could somehow get you onto this air-gapped network, is that something that we should freak out about? Should some lieutenant colonel in charge of that program be fired immediately? Because what if his options were, there's this terrible vulnerability and the only other software that is currently available is an unstable version that is known to flake out on a regular basis? So you're choosing between terrible vulnerability and you might lose steering at sporadic basis because the software wasn't super stable. I think we know the decision that we're going to make there. And articles like this and saying vulnerabilities don't really give you the intellectual space to talk about all the thing that goes into this.
I think that there's a certain, there is a certain subsect of either reporting or cybersecurity folks that are in this industry that feel like a zero tolerance policy is the best policy. Like, there was a vulnerability on your system, you're fired. I think that is a massive overreaction and, in fact, the absolute wrong thing to do. I think that we have to all accept that there will always be vulnerabilities in this process. There is simply no way we can escape that. If we think that, like, the DoD should write all of its own software for everything and, like, be the largest software vendor on the planet, and that somehow that's going to make them write perfect, secure software, ha 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 ha. That's just fantasy land. I think we have to get to a point where we say everything is going to be vulnerable at some point, but how we respond to those vulnerabilities and how we manage the risk of said vulnerabilities has to become a more mature process. Like, it shouldn't be a factor of, like, I wonder if we're going to find a vulnerability on this weapon system. It should be when we find a vulnerability on this weapon system, how are we going to respond? What are the types of vulnerabilities, given what we know about the industry, that we think we could see on this weapon system? And what is the tabletop exercise we're going to run through with what happens if X and what happens with Y and what happens with Z? And how are we going to demo this stuff? Are we going to war game this stuff? Are we going to actually, like, go into an exercise and simulate this, right? Like, oh crap, the switch that's inside of it has a bad software vulnerability. Okay, great. What are we going to do? I don't know, roll back 7 versions and see if the vulnerability is still there. You know, like,
yeah,
all these things that kind of have to happen. I do not want to see anybody relieved because of a vulnerability unless it is a vulnerability that they've known about and just done nothing for. And that's the point, right? Negligence versus reactivity is very different.
Yeah. And it would be interesting to see some kind of, for instance, MCPP, Marine Corps planning process example where your COA course of action strengths and weaknesses were able to somewhat incorporate this. Like, imagine being like, hey, so we've got an air COA and we've got a ground COA. We know of the following vulnerabilities or it is reasonable to assume that there could be the following vulnerabilities on the air side, following vulnerabilities on the ground side. Commander, you know, add this to your percentage success calculus or something along those lines. That would be an interesting way to imagine putting that into play. But I think we hit this fairly well. Shall we move on to what the article describes as the challenges?
Absolutely.
So they outline 3 major ones. The first one being supply chain. And at first I was like, yes, this was the same conclusion I came to. And then it went on to say the physical supply chain. And I was like, ooh, not the same conclusion I came to.
So close.
Yeah, because when they say physical supply chain, they're saying, and I'm not necessarily saying that I disagree that the physical supply chain is not important. For instance, where do we make raw materials? Where do we make chips? Where do we make steel? Where do we make all the different things that go into our weapon systems? That is a challenge to our strategic advantage. And I don't necessarily disagree with that. However, as you know, kind of the IT nerd, that is not where my head went initially. The compatibility and maintenance supportability, I have a whole diatribe on this. And then the modernization of systems with bolt-on IT/OT. Kyle, hit me with your takes first before I start going into this.
All right. So whenever I hear modernization of systems with bolt-on IT/OT, and when we talk about compatibility and maintenance, there's 2 schools of thought here, right? There is, okay, everyone hates that there are 200 different standards that we build things on. So you know what we're going to do? We're going to build another standard that we can get everybody to be on. And then all of a sudden there's 201 standards that exist out there and nobody's ever going to move to the 201st because their standard is just fine. There's a relevant XKCD article about this. I recommend everybody go read. And then the other problem, right? I'm going to also talk about solutions here. I'm not just going to be the complainer, is that if you decide, okay, great, we're going to standardize on this version of Linux and this version of Kubernetes and this version of, you know, SolarWinds, well, now vulnerability is now everywhere if there is a zero day for all of those systems. And your ability to respond to said vulnerability may be fast, may be slow. And if it's too slow, maybe you just lost everything that is standardized on that one thing. For example, if there was like the US DoD way of running IT and an adversary was able to take advantage through a series of zero days of that entire infrastructure, well, now what? Like, how do you do anything at that point? Have you just ground yourself to a halt? And so there is value in speed of development and consistency and training and go to market for war, if you will, in having a standard. But there's also risks in that standardization, right? Like, because I have 201 standards, if someone wants to compromise all 201 of them, that is a lot of effort. If you just want to compromise one, that feels, maybe it's not less effort, but it feels like an easier target because you've got one set of variables that you have to worry about. Is that kind of where we're going with this, John? I think I feel like I'm rambling to some extent.
No, I don't think you are. I think you're describing kind of the ghost fleet problem of, hey, if you put all your eggs in one basket and that basket goes, you better hope you have a ghost fleet floating out there or else you are dead in the water, right? So that's one thing I think you're talking about. And then everybody kind of seems to think this is a really easy answer is you just standardize on one. And yeah, the ghost fleet example tells you not to do that. But then if you also just diversify your options so widespread that you can't keep up with it from a patching and even just visualization standpoint, to the point where you don't even know how many different versions of Linux you have out there, for instance. All of these are problems, right? And I don't think necessarily it's an easy one-to-one. And we've seen with all of the vulnerabilities that it can be a problem. And really a kind of it, in some cases, it only kind of takes one, right?
Right. I would say that I would much rather have a mature response and rollback towards the discovery, disclosure, and remediation of vulnerabilities than I would have a single standard. Like, I'd much rather have 201 playbooks that say, here's how to move fast when we have a vulnerability and how to remediate that vulnerability and get back to control and kick whoever's in our systems out of our systems out fast, rather than I would say, here's one system. I think that there's better effort there.
I agree.
The cultural learning for having the fast remediation would be far more valuable than the one system to rule them all, right? Like, we all know how that worked out for Sauron. So let's avoid that.
Yeah. So again, not discounting the supply chain side of this, but I think it's far more complicated than that. And I would like to go into why I think it's more complicated than that. So when you say supply chain and go my supply chain, kind of the software supply chain vice, because this is a software article and it's kind of weird that we went to supply chain hardware. And I get, you know, Taiwan and chips and all that kind of stuff. Like, it's a thing. I get it.
I think it's tough to talk about one without the other in any way, right? Like,
fair.
They
chose specifically to talk about the physical supply chain, not the software supply chain.
Yeah, like, all it would have taken was another half a sentence to kind of talk about the bulking of those things together. But, you know, I worry where my chips are made too, because that's where the firmware is implemented, right?
Fair point.
Right. You know, I'm not worried about someone leaking the blueprints of things in the, like, ancient Soviet espionage capability. What I'm worried about is someone putting a zero day in the firmware of the, you know, RAM module that sits on top of a weapon system, where there's just, it's so difficult to flash that stuff. It's so difficult to change that stuff, or an EEPROM program that just, you can't even change without replacing the chip itself.
Yeah. And let's just go back through previous podcasts and what we've seen in the news recently. When you say you are going to secure the software supply chain, here's what that looks like. In a super simple environment, here's what that looks like. Some person is writing code on a laptop. So that laptop needs to be secured, because if you compromise that laptop and you change the software as they're writing it, then when it gets uploaded to all these secure systems, it's compromised. Then you have some sort of application or protocol that is most likely going to interact with that person's computer and bring that software to the repo, the software repository, where that software sits. So you have most likely a protocol that could be compromised there. Then you have that server. So that server probably is accessible by more than just this one person who writes code. So it's accessible by multiple people, most likely in the modern environment, different types of people, right? Contractors, uniformed people, non-DOD, academic advisor, and all of these are going to have different capabilities that they can bring, because not all of them can get a CAC, will have some sort of two-factor authentication, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But this thing needs to be available so that everybody can write the code there, right? So you have all of that kind of identity to secure. Then you have all the underlying stuff that sits under that software. Because on that repo, you're running some sort of operating system, Linux or Windows. You've got those native vulnerabilities. You're running some sort of application to do your repo. That application is going to have vulnerabilities. And most likely, from what I have previously seen, that software ends up on a manufacturer's website. So it's going to go from that repo, that source of truth, and somehow get uploaded to a website. Either a person is going to do that or a protocol is going to do that. And either of those are going to have vulnerabilities to them. Then it gets on the website. And depending on how accessible that website is, there's another vector. So when you say supply chain, that seems like, hey, NBD, secure the supply chain. I think I just illustrated, and we have talked about each and every one of those things throughout the last couple of podcasts. There's a lot that goes into that. Is not a trivial thing. And you might not be able to force that on everyone, or you might not be able to see or sense it. I don't know many contracts that we write where it's, hey, Kyle Industries provides me with a Seam dashboard that shows me every single time that Kyle logged on, what type of device he logged on with, was that within his baseline? Is that outside the, you know what I mean? Like,
and if they did, it wouldn't integrate with anything else.
And who's watching that?
Dude, right.
What is normal for Kyle? That's not a normal dude. You know what I mean?
Right.
Again, not easy things. So when you write it out here, it's almost like slap you across the face. Like, oh, we have to do this. And then when you dig into the details of how you would actually do that, spoiler, maybe yeah. More complicated.
Right. 100%.
So moving on, the article mentions that with the 2016 NDAA, they talked about in the NDAA,
acronym check.
Sorry, National Defense Authorization Act. That kind of mainly gives the DOD money, so we pay attention. And if you want to get the monies, you need to be able to do the things that are laid out there. So kind of, if you will, a bit of a report card, people pay attention to this. So in the 2016 NDAA, and has been since, as I understand, we were directed to do reports scoping these vulnerabilities, but the article lays out it doesn't assign accountability measures or funding to get after those vulnerabilities. So you say, hey, write some reports talking about the vulnerabilities we have, but there's no money to get after it. And I think the assumption that, you know, reading between the lines here, I think the assumption is, hey, we paid somebody to make these weapon systems, whatever they may be. We did not pay them to bring in outside companies, run red teams or scans or whatever against all this stuff, find vulnerabilities, fix vulnerabilities, and then deliver us a product post that. I think that's generally what that is saying, or what that is hoping that the user will bring from it. Is that what you got from that, Kyle?
Yeah, I think so. And note that reading the entire NDAA is long, and John and I have not read that thing cover to cover. Shocker. But I think John's interpretation of this is accurate. We have not mandated that the developers of said weapon systems take into account their own remediation. This comes back to this concept where if I'm a company and I buy a SaaS product from somebody and there's a problem with that SaaS product, I go to them and I say, I need you to fix your product because it's broken in some way. It's very rare, or at least I have never seen it, where I order or buy something from a company that is SaaS, and when it is broken, it's my problem to fix. But that is somewhat the situation that we have in place right now, is that when the DoD acquires these weapon systems, the owner of said weapon system is not the one we generally would go to remediate these. It would be the DoD element that owns said weapon system's responsibility. So I'm going to use a terrible example here, but you know, like the Air Force buys something from Northrop Grumman or General Dynamics, right? Like, and they discover a vulnerability. It's not like you ship it back to Northrop Grumman for them to patch it. You patch it. They may give you guidance, but you still patch it. And I think that the authors of this article are recommending that there be language put into that place that says each of these vendors need to have the ability to patch the software, to own that process, and that we should go to them and it should overwhelmingly be their responsibility. I think that is somewhat immature, only because now you are saying, okay, Northrop Grumman or General Dynamics, like, you now have to have persistent and ready access to all of these systems, as they are going, or we need to create some tunnel that we can turn a key and turn on for you so that you can get in and edit and modify these systems, all of which makes me pucker pretty hard, where I kind of like the idea that the DoD is responsible for that, but that is not without problems.
Well, I was going to say, there's a whole, that's the way you looked at it is, hey, you need to fix these things. And you automatically went to bring the vendor into the environment. I kind of went the other direction. I was like, okay, if you want me to be responsible and you want me to do this, okay, vendor, I'm going to need source code. I'm going to be able to scan all of your stuff. I'm going to be able to run red team software.
Who's doing that?
And we have talked about this. One, who's doing that is a great question. But there are people that can do that. And we have people that are trained to do that. But like we've talked about before, when we talked about open source and we talked about black box, that is those vendors' intellectual property. If we have all of the source code, then we can theoretically turn that over to our uniform developers and just have them develop from there. Now, I'm not saying that that is what we would do, but I think you would get a strong argument from the vendors if you said, hand over all of your source code and every tool that you used so that we can bounce, you know, every tool you use, tell us all the vulnerabilities that tool had. One, I think you're looking really dangerous territory, and this is difficult for people to solve. And most cases, if you're going to do it like this, it is not going to be cost effective for you. And I think if there's one thing that you can universally get the US public fired up about is the DoD budget. And so if you're going to say, okay, for us to really take this seriously, we're going to start paying twice as much for all of our defense toys, that is not going to play well. I think really, really challenging just inside of that space. And it is even more complicated than that.
Agree. And we're just tip of the iceberg on all this stuff too. It's like the more layers you pull back, the harder, more difficult, more different color of money problems that you run into at whose responsibility is what. And that's why I keep coming back to, I like the fact that it is the sort of warfighter's responsibility to troubleshoot and patch their weapon system. I think this is to some extent, you know, tap, rack, bang on your M4, but far more complicated with many, many, many more steps, where the vendor, I think, should provide a lot of that remediation methodology. But let's just assume that you've got your, you know, your fancy new aircraft that is flying in the sky. I'm going to use a Top Gun Maverick thing and say your fifth generation aircraft. Yeah, that's right. Fifth gen, whatever that means. By the way, go see that movie. It's pretty amazing. You've got your new weapon system that's in the sky and you've discovered a vulnerability, or like something just fell out of the sky and you know that there's now a vulnerability and you've got the logs and you know what the problem is. Like, how do you, with planes in the air, do an over the air patch, right? How do you, with planes on an aircraft carrier, do a patch while they're sitting on the aircraft carrier, right? Like, you can't just FedEx those things and RMA them back to wherever they were manufactured in the United States so that you can swap out a piece of hardware. Like, this is a logistic nightmare in the moment.
Should you ever do an over the air patch on something that is in the air?
Right. I mean, there's a lot of concerns in a lot of the words that I just said. And if you are someone in air crew and you didn't just, you know, knife hand your car speaker or headphones, I'm concerned about you. You should have. I said some dumb stuff there, but these are the problems that we have to contend with, right? Okay, great. A Joint Strike Fighter just fell out of the sky, and we know that there's a vulnerability where there is a ground-based laser that is able to take them down, right? Like, now what? Okay, we've got 20 others that are in flight right now. Do we ground them? Like, they have active missions, right? We know what the patch is. There's a new version of Kubernetes. I don't know. I'm just picking something out of the sky, right? That we need to roll out, and we can probably do a container reboot in a couple milliseconds that won't impact flight operations. Or I know nothing of how that's actually rolled out. I'm making stuff up as I go, but you're just seeing like this has many layers.
Sir, theoretically, I can reboot this in flight and it will not affect anything. What would you like me to do?
Right.
Meanwhile, the captain up in the air with his hand on the stick, like all blood left his face. He's like, not that.
And no one's going to make that call, right? Like when the life of a pilot is on the line, the ground commander, do not put that person into that position. Do not put the pilot into that position, right? Like, let's have figured this out before they're in the air with a problem that needs to be over the air rebooted. Let's not be in that position. Let's have a methodology from the manufacturer that says, if you have a critical vulnerability, we've tested this. We've tested this in simulation. We've tested this in the test aircraft. We've tested this in real world. We've done this in different environments and different exercises before. No one right now is about to enter uncharted territory with a multi-million-dollar aircraft and a pilot's life on the line. That's what I want.
Yes, I think we've hit this well. Here's one last point I want to get in before we move on. So when we talk about at the beginning or a couple sentences ago, we said, hey, we were given money from Congress to study the problem, but not the money to actually remediate it. I think it's a little tricky when you look at it like that, because one, yes, without money, I think it's a joke, or it is mildly amusing to me if you have not funded it. However, when we talk about vulnerabilities from vendors, you've got a real balancing act here, right? Because I have seen vendors get skewered on other podcasts for patching things, because they're like, hey, we are the most aggressive patching vendor in the history. And in their sales material, it's like, we patched 2,000 Cat 1 vulnerabilities. And then the IT podcasts are like, you had 2,000 Cat 1 vulnerabilities in your software? It is terrible. You should get no credit for patching that.
Right. So, like, hold it's on. Got, we're it's all one focusing of those on things. The wrong thing.
how are we going to incentivize this? Are you gonna take your standard military vendor and say, hey, I'll give you $1 million for every 10 vulnerabilities that you patch? Mm-hmm. At what point are we gonna find ourselves with a GAO report where a vendor either was lackadaisical in the initial writing so that they could make a couple, you know, like, because stockholders got to get theirs, like, so that they could get a couple extra. Like, there, when you build enforce, or when you build rewards into a system that are problematic to begin with, you know what is going to happen from there. And so I think we need to consider this very carefully when you talk about how we would work with vendors on vulnerabilities.
I think you're 100% accurate there.
Very carefully. In a rare John step, I don't think I have a recommendation here other than be very careful with this. Unintended consequences will likely follow.
I think that's a key element. We rush things, and I don't think that's a bad thing. I like to be agile. Like, I like to fail fast. I want to move quickly. And, you know, John and I both have deep experience with, you know, fielding communication systems where they're so old that the warranties on the UPSs have already expired by the time they hit the fleet. And, you know, that's the running joke, but that's legit. That's real. That's sad. And I want things like that to move faster. I think that inherently you give up some security when you move faster. That's just a part of the problem. And I think that if you go read some of these reports, and in particular, we haven't talked about this one, but there is a GAO report that is referenced in this article as well, which is significantly longer. It's a few hundred pages. But it is the Weapon Systems Annual Assessment from 2021 last year. The new one should be coming out fairly quickly, which talks about the assessment methodology and stuff. And they specifically call this out. They say that the number one risk to software development is the speed that these vendors feel they need to move at. And almost every one of the vendors identified a risk of developing software quickly that is detrimental to their software security or their software security lifecycle in some way, shape, or form. So I want speed, and all I want is for security not to be third, right? That's always the joke, is security third, but I want that not to be the case. I want security to be first, and I want us to think about, or at least have some general methodology to say, we know how we are going to respond, or we've tested a few of these things, right? Like, we know that vulnerabilities are going to be found. So here's vulnerability remediation, you know, small, medium, and large. Right? Like, underlying kernel circuitry vulnerability, here's the remediation steps that we think are the fastest, and we've tried a bunch. And, you know, or you got a minor version upgrade that has a minor vulnerability, here's how you can do that. And, you know, small and medium are totally fine to do while the aircraft's in motion, right? They're you know, redundant systems everywhere, like, things are going to be just fine. Whereas a major, you have to have the airframe grounded and blah, 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 like, just that level of detail. And I think that we can learn a lot where, I'm going to keep picking on these two companies just because they're top of mind for me, but, you know, I want to see Northrop Grumman's playbook, and I want General Dynamics to look at that playbook and go, oh crap, they thought about this. The R team totally didn't think about it. Let's do that. Right. And so that there's some collective learning from the industry as we go through this, where maybe we incentivize who's got the better remediation program. I get a little nervous when you start saying, like, for every 10 remediations, we're going to give you $1 million because someone's going to game that and just release the buggiest software they could possibly get to market so that they could make money off of that remediation program. But what I want to see is a sort of some competition where we award the best security playbook from the best vendor, and then that up levels everybody else's game in some way, shape, or form. I don't know. And I'm just spitballing here, but I think that we have to use the carrot, not the stick, and make the carrot global quality improvement, not micro quality improvement.
I like that. That's a good recommendation. I can't wait to read that playbook.
Yeah, me too.
So Kyle,
you'll get a chance to read it. I'll never get a chance to read it. It'll be secret, but it, you know, you can tell me if it's great.
Like, hey Kyle, I read this document. It was great. It was called this,
redacted. You'll never get a chance to see it, right? Redacted. Yeah. I can't tell you anything about it, but it was awesome.
Yeah. It was so cool. You learned so much.
Yep. Okay. So I think we're going to take this into the end of this article. So they finish it out with other steps to take is the title of the heading. And they outline four particular things that they're recommending. The first of which is to expand existing programs. And basically, the DoD should expand their programs to cover a wider range of systems and establish plans to address cybersecurity vulnerabilities in older systems. This is basically saying, get better, right? Give more money, make things better, make things bigger. Which, sure, you've got my enthusiastic thumbs up. But like that very incredible GIF is, but how is what I want to know. And this article doesn't even remotely begin to address that concern, which I understand, as John and I have just ended up talking about. It is complicated, but they're saying keep going, which 100% I agree with. So number one, expand existing programs, 100%. Now, they talk about including remediation up front, and they talk about how Congress should approve language for the inclusion in the NDAA around remediation for cyber incidents and the finalization of commercial technology maturation and expansion into DoD programs and weapon systems. I think John and I covered this too, which is include remediation up front, meaning what's the methodology for how we remediate? And if we can do that, awesome. Do I think that that should take congressional language in the NDAA to accomplish? I absolutely do not. Do I think that the industry or any of these vendors should wait for Congress to approve that language in the NDA in order to do this? Absolutely not. So I think that there is a chicken and egg problem here where that should be the expectation. And whether that's from each program manager inside of the DoD that's fielding these systems, or whether that's a congressionally mandated piece, I want some hate and discontent to say, your remediation methodology sucks, make it better.
Yeah, and I would also add to there, you could probably put some contracting language in from everything procured from now on that essentially says one of the largest ways you will be evaluated is through how quickly we can remediate and how you are able to identify and solve problems prior to the software making it to the warfighter. So somewhat written in a way to where you almost have to build yourself a SecDevOps type setup, mm-hmm. or you have to line out why doing some sort of SecDevOps pipeline is not the right thing to do for these reasons, so that you're essentially showing your homework for how you've made remediation a priority.
Agree with that completely. Okay, third point is to create a baseline. It says Congress needs to include language directing the DoD to address serial data network vulnerabilities, certify a baseline to track technological improvements, and build upon efforts to reduce cybersecurity risk. I think that recommending a baseline gets us back to what we talked about 10 minutes ago on this cast, which is that if you have a baseline, I fear that the DoD will not be able to keep up with an approved baseline. I think that the target will move far too fast. This is like chasing the golden snitch, right? Like, good luck. You may catch it someday, but today may not be that day. And it's just going to keep moving faster. So establishing a baseline that is somehow directed by Congress scares me. I do not want that. They will not move fast enough to keep up with that baseline. There needs to be some other agency or sub-agency or delegated control where someone else can create a baseline. And even then, a baseline for what? And for what system? And which of those 200 or 201 standards that we've talked about previously? This is hard. And I think has diminishing returns to a point.
Yeah. And to the point, if your baseline is this number of Cat 1s, this number of Cat 2s, this number of Cat 3, this number of Cat 4, that is the wrong answer. I can definitively say that ain't the right thing. So mm-hmm. if that is the way that you're implementing a baseline, or said another way, a hastily put together baseline, I would argue possibly more detrimental than no baseline.
Yes, 100% agree. Okay, and the last one is accountability measures. The article recommends that we codify mechanisms to assess progress against legislative and policy requirements, and such efforts should hold the DoD responsible for ensuring the security and readiness of these joint force weapon systems. Now, this again is where things get... This one I disagree with, and this is personal, but again, the DoD being held responsible for the security and readiness of all these weapon systems is not the right answer in this person's opinion, right? Again, they don't write the software. They don't have the intellectual property. They're not building the system. There is a specific reason that we subcontract these out. There's a specific reason that there's a bidding process and other people build this, because that capability, that specialization does not natively exist within the DoD. And in almost all cases, nor should it, in my opinion. There is a reason that other people and other businesses exist, and that we don't just have one gigantic military industrial complex as part of this nation's defense. That's good. But the thought process that the DoD should be held solely responsible for all this stuff really gets us back to this talk about whether or not we should develop all the things inside the DoD, or whether or not we should actively embrace the commercial sector and open source technology and all these other things the same way that lots of commercial vendors are. And I get it, right? We've talked this one to death. There are benefits and there are consequences to each of those decisions. But I firmly believe that we should not be talking about DoD platforms. We should be talking about the DoD's mission across all of these particular pieces, and the building of some universal utopian DoD-wide platform for technology is not great, in my opinion. I think that there is a lot of technology that exists in the outside world, and we should put smart technologists in the ability to sort of review those sorts of things as they're going to market, i.e. getting fielded in the military or the DoD, and focus on the mission, right? I'm consistently brought back to the talk about Kessel Run, right? Kubernetes on airframes. That was 5 years ago, right? 5 years. At this point, right, enlisted people have come in and gotten out since that program has been live running those things. And so shouldn't the Air Force just be like tip of the spear software development right now? Shouldn't they just be doing the most amazing stuff on the planet with every weapon system that they field and using the latest technology? And yet, where are we? I think this is sort of a pre-hot take from Kamo, but I am disappointed, right? Like full on disappointed in where we've been focusing, because there was this shining example of what we could do and we've gone the whole other direction.
So I had two things. Now you've given me three things. One, I will stick up for the brethren at Kessel Run and say, they're not the ones developing the weapons. But you like, if they could just solve world hunger and cancer and all the things all at the same time, Middle East.
Yeah, like what are they doing right now? It's
InnoSec
Sunday,
DevOps,
right?
pipeline. That's what we're asking for here. I get it. Yes, but the two things I want to say here is, one, I am scared just at the words that you see there. Codify mechanisms to assess progress against legislative and policy requirements.
Mm-hmm.
Have we codified mechanisms to assess how well that the thing works in combat? Have we codified mechanisms to talk about how we are able to quickly and rapidly adapt to the problems that we see, how we can take the data from those systems and push it to other systems, how we can do things that we didn't intend it initially for so that we can win the next war? Like, we are not talking about iterations that are going to make us more lethal. We're talking about progress against legislative and policy requirements. And this, dear listeners, is how joy and fun and winning goes to die, because because your talented manpower is going to you as the general or whoever that or Congress that's going to dictate. We only have so many CPU cycles in each of our brains. If we're spending most of our CPU cycles worried about legislative and policy requirements and not how well the thing actually works, This is where it is all going to break down. And I have seen this many, many cases. Is your best talent working on your hardest problems, or are they working on legislative and policy requirements? We need to talk about this, as it is not a zero sum, right? It is zero sum. If you're going to take it off here, it's coming off of something else. So we need to think really long and hard about that. And then I also, because
I'll gently challenge that. I don't think it's zero sum. I think that you can spend effort in areas and get far more reward for that. And to your point, spending that effort, those very, you know, those limited number of brain CPU cycles on legislative and policy requirements is a choice that we could make. And I think that there are much better, higher return on investment choices that we could make in other locations.
Yes. And then the other thing I did want to point out is you were saying that stuff and you, one could argue, you know, if you're one of the vendors kind of listening in on this, it might have felt like we were being a bit harsh. So I want to give a vendor appreciation moment for a second here. They could give us the most secure, most amazing weapon system. And if we took the metaphorical M16 and pointed the barrel towards ourselves and pulled the trigger, then it didn't work the way that they intended it to work, right? And so implementation matters, and it is never going to be a 100% vendor problem or a 100% DoD problem, right? All of the stuff that we've seen, all of the different vulnerabilities, there have been people going to people. There's been a case of that.
Oh, yeah.
And that also needs to be reflected because IT is not super simple. These things are pretty complex. The way you implement it is going to have ramifications on all of this, both positive and negative. Mm-hmm. And so we shouldn't be too harsh on the vendors, I don't think, because, you know, to my point of like, is a Cat 1 vulnerability a big deal if that should never happen in this environment? I mean, eventually it's something you hope to get to, but when you're making a choice about those limited cycles, if you're working on the most realistic and potential threats, maybe things on paper don't look as good as they are in reality.
Yeah, and there's a bunch to that, obviously, but no, for the record, we're not trying to beat up on partners at all. What we're trying to say is all of us can do better. And I think that that starts with increased partnership, right? Where I don't like the Boolean idea of like, is vendor's responsibility or is DoD's responsibility? I like the idea of like, is all people's responsibility to make sure that this is in a way. And here's the things that the vendor will own. They agree to it. It's not being forced upon them. Here's the things the DoD owns. They agree to it. It's not forced on. And here's how we check and balance each other to make sure that we're each doing our jobs effectively. That feels like a partnership. That feels like a way that we all decide we're going to get better. Not that we're going to strong arm you into getting better, but that we're going to do it because it is the right thing to do. So yeah, I love vendors. Vendors make way better, cooler stuff than anyone in the DoD can generally make. And I want them to continue doing that because I want us to continue having incredible capabilities that we can use to help in national defense and in, you know, implementation of policy worldwide. That being said, I don't want us to be willy-nilly about it, and I don't want us to just be like pew, pew, pew from the hip every time. I want us to think about how we're going to do these things so that we don't end up in a situation where the weapon system becomes the big threat.
Great points. Kyle, we are at that time, that Kyle's hot, hot take time.
All right, so today's been a lot. I think today's been kind of like a one-hour hot take to some extent about us talking through this. I think my hot take is I want our listeners to talk about this with the people that are in their sphere of influence, right? Go read this article and, you know, set up a Google News alert for the term cybersecurity and DoD and read them. Read what people are talking about. And I know that that can be sometimes mind-numbing. And yes, you're going to get a lot of clickbaity titles. And there is an argument to be made that this one is among them. But you can use the kernels, you know, the non-Linuxy definition of that, the kernels of truth inside of each of these to have good conversations with your peers, with your higher commands, with your subordinate commands about how we can and should do better about this. All of this change starts with us listening through this. As much as, you know, there are one or two humans who are going to elicit this change, if you are one of those two humans and you're out here listening to this, let's do it. Let's go. You have our support. You have the support of the listeners in this cast. Like, let's go make these changes because it's the only way it's going to happen. It's going to start bottom up and it's going to start top down. We're going to have a pincher approach to this. And let's continue to focus on the mission. Let's not continue to focus on the platform.
Dear listeners, thank you for joining us. You can connect with us on social media by going to Twitter and following @USMC_. TFPHOENIX. That's at USMC_TaskForcePhoenix. Our editor is Sarah Clarkson, and marketing support is provided by Jake Osborne. You can support the cast by going to Apple Podcasts and leaving us a 5-star review and accompanying comment. Or you can go to Twitter and do some interaction there too. But let's get those numbers up. And with that, we are out.